AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Happy 2020 to everyone out there listening, from myself and everyone here at AM 950. Oh, I hope you had a wonderful New Year's. Now, we are not here yet. Once again, another brand new to you show here on AM 950. And today, two political juggernauts within the state who are working for the DFL to help make 2020 even a better year for us. Representative Rena Moran, she is the head of the Health and Human Services Committee in the House. She talks about health care in 2019 and 2020. And Senator Ron Latz, he joins us as well, talking about the issues and especially the issues facing the Senate Democrats coming into 2020. We'll take a break. Come on back with the representative when we return right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. We've talked a lot about a lot of legislative issues throughout the entire year. Healthcare is one that keeps coming up, and I am pretty sure it's going to be a massive issue once again in 2020. It is my absolute privilege and pleasure to welcome on in Representative Rena Moran. She is representing District 65A, fighting St. Paul, as well as also she is the chair of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee in the House, and she's kind enough to spend some time with us today to talk about the legislative session that was and the legislative session that will be. Representative, thank you very much for the time.
Well, it's great to be on the the media so early in the morning. But let me just say happy holidays to everyone, and I look forward to this conversation around healthcare.
Well, and happy holidays to you as well, and to all your constituents there. You, of course, Health and Human Services. We saw in the 2018 election. I mean, it was clearly an issue most people care about, and an issue the opposition party hasn't really cared about prior to 2018. I mean, obviously, Democrats had major wins because people trusted them to be the party that was going to fight for their health care and better health care and more options. So 2019, you're the chair of the committee here. Let's talk about some of the things that you got accomplished in the 2019 session.
Okay, well, thank you for that and a highlight. And you are so correct that health care is, I believe, the number one issue that is on individuals and families' mind every single day. It is something that Democrats in the legislature and around the country has worked so hard to fight for and secure and to maintain. And it seems to, once again, be under attack. So we have to make sure that we are providing access to individuals, not only, locally, but across the state of Minnesota. So some of the major accomplishments that we were able to successfully do in 2019, this last legislative session, was one of the biggest hurdle was this whole provider tax, which is really used to finance Minnesota care in the medical assistance program for 1.2 million Minnesotans. And so the Republicans were fighting to sunset it, which would have had a huge impact to access. And so we was able to reduce that tax from 2.0 to 1.8 in exchange for just removing any further sunset that may happen with the provider tax. We were able to pass a comprehensive Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Protection Act, which set up a licensure framework for assisted living facilities in Minnesota. And why this is so important is that we have heard over some time now about elder abuse. Minnesota is the only state in the country where assisted living facilities are not licensed. So this is like a huge move to make sure that we set up a licensure framework for assisted living facilities in Minnesota. We also reformed the payment system for disability waiver services to make wages more competitive and sustain for caregiver workforce. We know PCA workers and other care workers in the workforce are not making really a good livable wages. And so we want to make sure that we are taking care of those who are giving back and taking care of our elders and others with disabilities to make sure that they themselves are able to be taken care of through a strong workforce. We was able to increase the licensing fee for the opioid manufacturers and dedicate $20 million of new revenue to go towards the opioid epidemic, which we know is rapid across the state of Minnesota and across this country. And with those dollars that come in, that we would use those funds for prevention, education, and treatment. We require licensures for the pharmacy benefit managers, those PBMs, to increase the transparency for a secretive part of the pharmaceutical market that has helped drive up prescription drug prices. So we're going to keep them accountable, too. And we also created other avenues to affordable prescription drugs, including an emergency refill protocol and a statewide repository program for people to donate their excess medication. Mm-hmm.
You've done so. I mean, people seem to forget. We always focus, I think, sometimes on the stuff that doesn't get done. There is a lot of stuff that does get done. You brought up the fact that it's healthcare is a top of mind awareness. The healthcare cost now for a family, even with the Affordable Care Act, broke $20,000 per year for the first time ever for a family of four. So it's going to continue to be. But let's go back to two things here that you guys passed here, and let's talk a little bit more about them. The Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Care Act, we talk about, especially in rural Minnesota, we have an aging population, and it's skyrocketing. It's something that it's in a lot of these communities. It's not something where the community is prepared for this. The state obviously has a vested interest to make sure our elder citizens and our vulnerable adults are taken care of correctly here. Was there how much common ground was there with the Republican Party in the Senate in regards to dealing with this? Because I got to believe this is one that was pretty much most people were on board with. You at least hope that would have been the case.
And you're absolutely right. Elder care and to be able to take care of our elders with some dignity and respect and make sure that if they are able to stay in their homes as long as they can in their community, as long as they can and want to, that we are making that available. That is the number one priority. But in the case where that can no longer, where that is no longer the case, we want to make sure that our assisted living facilities are safe, that they are being cared for with the utmost care and dignity, that they are in a safe environment, and families feel good about where they are. And, often you would think that that's a very bipartisan idea, that we want to invest in that. But it was, although at the end it prevailed, it wasn't an easy path with our Republican colleagues. And this really does impact the rural community where you have hospitals and facilities closing at a higher rate. And we have families who have to travel a further distance to be with their loved ones, to be with their parents, their grandparents, their aunts. But at the end, it did prevail. And I know as Democrats, we are going to continue to work to ensure that we have licensed assistance facilities. Many of our Republican colleagues felt that, being licensed was a burden to many of the facilities. But the reports that we were hearing from constituencies about the conditions that their loved ones were in these facilities made it really necessary for us as Democrats to fight to ensure that we're the outlier, we're no longer be an outlier when it comes to having licensed facilities that are taking care of our most vulnerable adults and working to ensure that we were making it a priority for our elders to be taken care of as they age in transition in life.
The other issue, I think, which is so important, the opiate epidemic. I mean, there's been some national cases that have shown that manufacturers of opiates were very knowledgeable at how dangerous they were. This is an epidemic that deserves to get a lot more attention. There has been, in certain elements, pushback on on attempts to hold the pharmaceutical industries responsible for the opioid epidemic accountable. But to be able to get $20 million to help people with opiate addiction, it is still something today, which, I mean, I've had surgical procedures and I'll go in and I'll say, oh, can I have something besides opiates? And, you know, it's almost like the healthcare industry is like, no, you have to take them. And I'm like, I don't want them. So, you have this case where, you know, it's still going to be prescribed. So having the ability to have some, you know, money for treatment, I think is a definite win.
It is a definite win, and this is a win in a big way because of residents in the state of Minnesota. The DFL did something that had not happened in a very long time, is that we took our hearings out into the communities across the state of Minnesota, onto the reservations, on into those rural communities, to hear the stories from the people of Minnesota. And I think this was a big driving factor as to how we came to this final number. And I would say it probably isn't enough. It's a good starting point to really keep manufacturers accountable to this crisis that we find ourselves in today.
Mm-hmm. There's one issue I definitely want to bring up that did not get passed. This is the Alex Smith Emergency Insulin Act. The Senate Republicans, who had agreed to it, they basically backed out inexplicably. They have been ever since blaming the Democrats when, once again, the bill was agreed to. It was the Senate Republicans that pulled it. We've talked on my radio show. We know of people who have died trying to ration insulin since the Republicans, you know, reneged on the deal. But the reality is they keep trying to play politics. Their whole argument now is that, well, we're ready to pass our bill. All the governor has to call it, and acting like you in the House have no say in this matter. I mean, it really is. It's insulting not only to the diabetics who can't afford insulin, but it's insulting to you and the governor because, frankly, you guys were on board. You went in with trust, and really, I think we learned that we can't, even with something like emergency insulin, can't necessarily trust the Republicans to come forward and do the right thing.
Well, you nailed it, right? We, as Democrats, came in early in the session as this been a priority. The Alex Smith Emergency Insulin Act was and is a priority for the Democrats because, yes, we have individuals, because of the rising cost of insulin, who are rationing their insulin. This is it's not something like an aspirin you could take when you have a headache or not. This is a life-saving drug that is needed. And the Republicans, you know, which we go into it and give faith, believing that this is as much of a priority for them as it is for the Democrats and the people across the state of Minnesota. But they failed us. Mm-hmm. They failed the people. They failed the people in the state of Minnesota by not coming through in the Senate and working with the Democrats in the House to pass a strong bill that really sets a perimeter around creating a process where people can have emergency insulin when they need it. It is a life-saving. It's a life-saving drug, and so I just want the people in the state of Minnesota to know that the Democrats in the House worked very hard and diligently. You know, this was a really emotional intercession where I saw some of my colleagues who had invested a huge amount of time, energy, resource, and just fate believing that the Republicans would do the right thing. Cry. Yeah. I mean, cry because we had not done this. We know this is a life-saving drug for so many people across the state of Minnesota. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, as you stated, good faith is not enough. Trust is not enough. We need the people of the state of Minnesota to show up and really have their voices heard around this issue and show the Republicans in the Minnesota House and Senate in the legislature that this is a priority for them. And we will show them that by going to the polls and voting in people who care about the health and well-being of Minnesotans across the state of Minnesota, across the state.
We're definitely not using needy people to try to get another tax break for the wealthy or another, you know, conciliatory stance with a corporation or a corporate industry. You know, it's saying, hey, you know what, this is the right thing to do. And by the way, one thing I do love about the Republican ideas of emergency insulin is the 10-day waiting period before you can actually get it. I mean, it is truly, you know, how they could have screwed this up, I don't know, but they keep flailing while this is done. But what has happened has happened. We've got 2020 here. Let's talk a little bit of what's going to be your focus as the chair. Once again, Representative Rena Moran is joining us right now, the chair of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee in the House. What's going to be your focus as we head into 2020?
You know, we really thought that we would do an emergency session and come back to finish this work around insulin, because, you know, the price of insulin has tripled in the last decade. You know, we got studies that indicate that 1 in 4 diabetics have resorted to, as you said, rationing their insulin. And we need to get this done around this Alex Smith Act that would establish an emergency supply of insulin for diabetics who are unable to pay for a prescription refill immediately. And so that would be our number one priority. We will go in working to get this done, to make sure it happens, that it happens. I mean, that is, like, really, really critical. And my hope is that, you know, we can do this in a bipartisan way, because we need right now, because the Republican is a Senate Republican, that they will come into this session doing the right thing. So that's number one. Number two is that we... Since the ACA was adopted, we know that with this individual mandate that has been stricken, that we will continue to work to ensure that we can make some progress in reducing the uninsured rates for individuals, mm-hmm. that we can continue to work to ensure that there is nothing that will happen to protect coverage for those with pre-existing conditions, and to assure that they can receive care that they need regardless of what's happening at the federal level. We need to protect that, and we need to work to ensure that we are covering as many people as possible here in the state of Minnesota, and not working to, you know, cut people off of health insurance. Mm-hmm. So going in strong, you know, the Alex Emergency Act, the Emergency Insulin Act would be number one priority, making sure that we can maintain the Affordable Care Act, specifically looking to make sure that anyone with pre-existing condition is not under attack by the Republicans. And that we have some safeguards in place right here in the state of Minnesota.
Moving away from health and human service policy, has Speaker Hortman talked to you a little bit about any of the other priorities coming down the line for the House?
Well, we have not yet come together, and there are many priorities. And because it is a policy year, we're going to focus this next session on just policy pieces of legislation and bonding. Those two are the priorities for the House. You know, we did our budget last session. I'm not too sure yet what these other priorities would be in other areas. You know, my focus is the health and human service area, which is really, really important to me. That would be, you know, what I will continue to put my time and energy with. But, I mean, there are some things around education, around transportation, you know, clean air. We want to make sure that we continue to focus on those pieces of legislation. There's a lot of work coming down right now around the Family First Prevention Services Act, mm-hmm. where we're looking at out-of-home placement in our foster care system. Because of the opioid epidemic, we're finding that there are many more children who are being removed from their homes and put into foster care. And with this Family First Prevention Transitional Act, what that would do is allow a more focus on keeping families together. It would focus on allowing families to go through treatment together with their children. It's looking at congregate housing and moving away from housing children of 20 and 30 in out-of-home placement in these foster care systems and moving them more into a more of a family setting. Mm-hmm. So that would be a lot of the work that we do going forward. In 2019 session, we were able to do some conformity at the federal level. And so right now we're in the process of, the DHS, Department of Human Services, has created work groups to look at what the prevention looks like, what are the goals of Family First Prevention Transitional Act, and looking at congregate housing and what would that look like with this legislation that is coming down from the federal government around Family First Prevention Services Act.
And Representative, we easily filled 20 minutes here. We have to wrap it up. I will say this. I do hope that the House does take up some common sense gun regulation, because we desperately need that in this country. And I think that the leadership that we have, with your and self included, we're going to get something like that done. It depends on how stubborn the Republicans are going to be in the Senate, but hopefully we can get some of that done as well. But you're doing just such wonderful work. Congratulations on a productive 2019. I pray that what your committee is pushing for in 2020 does get done, because I think we're lucky to have leadership like yourself on that committee in the House.
I appreciate that, and thank you so much. It's been an honor and a privilege to chair Health and Human Service Policy Committee. We have great other Democrats who are really fighting really hard to ensure that we're creating access. In relationship to the gun laws, that is the number one priority for the Democrats.
Yes.
We just feel some really common sense gun controls, and the Republicans at all ends and all means have not come to the table to move some good, strong gun safety policies forward.
Sam.
So that I'm sure we're going to continue to do that. It just makes sense. Too many young people have lost their lives to gun control and to gun violence. And so we can do better. We know we can do better.
Absolutely.
And we're going to continue to fight to ensure that we are doing just that.
Representative Rita Moran. Representative, thank you very much. You are welcome back on my show anytime, by all means.
And all right.
Happy holidays to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. My next guest is someone I have talked with a few times. He is my state senator. I can't tell you how happy I am that he is my state senator. Senator Ron Latch represents District 46 in the DFL. He's kind enough today to talk with us about the last year and the upcoming year here in the Minnesota Senate. Senator Latch, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Good to be here, Matt. Thank you.
My pleasure. I saw a story. It sounds like the Senate Republicans just recently, and just considering this is a little more top of mind, obviously they have got an issue here. They got a 2020 election. They don't have exactly the most popular president in the country in the office, so there's going to be some coattail issues. You have a lot of suburban senators on the Republican side who, well, frankly, the Republican platform is out of touch for their district, and they're trying to find ways to make them seem more moderate than they really are. There was a Senate panel that was meeting on gun control issues. The Republicans were putting out there. The argument seems to be, well, we've got plenty of good laws on the books. We don't need to do anything else. You are part of that discussion. Talk a little bit about that, if you can.
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee has been stalling on this issue since after the 2016 election. I've been asking for hearings on the two bills that I'm carrying to expand background checks and to enact red flag abilities to take the guns away from people who are in crisis. And the chair has refused to give me a substantive hearing on those bills for over 2 years now. They decided, because of the political circumstances, and I think because they've got some members that are going to face political risk over this issue, that they'd want to appear to be dealing with this more directly. And they decided to have a hearing at which staff described existing laws. Now, normally I don't have a problem with, you know, educating members on what existing law is, but it seemed to me that their real purpose was not to find out what the existing laws ought to make, but rather make it appear as if they're doing something substantive on this topic. And whenever you review a lot of statutes, you're going to find areas where you can make changes here or changes there to try to improve things a bit. But the most important point that came out of this hearing, in my judgment, was what existing laws don't do. They don't provide for background checks for most of the private gun sales that occur private person to private person. All of the sales that don't go through a federally licensed dealer just happen person to person, like you're selling a candy bar to each other, except here you're selling lethal weapons. And the other thing they don't do is provide a tool for judges to order that a person who's in crisis give up their firearms, or that law enforcement take away the firearm until that crisis has passed. And in Minnesota, that crisis most often takes the form of suicidal thoughts or threats. So quite directly, we're saving lives here. This is not only about the mass shootings. Mm-hmm. In fact, mass shootings are quite rare. It's mostly about preventing suicides and then to some extent preventing the one-to-one violent single victim or two-victim kinds of crimes, which are obviously quite serious themselves, but which don't make the headlines in the same way that the mass shootings.
It should be mentioned, gun control, common sense gun controls, which you just talked about, are wildly popular, not only here in the metro area, but outstate Minnesota as well. It's generally an issue that gets 80 or higher percent approval rating as far as common sense gun control. And what you just described, the lack of background checks between sales, as well as also the inability to remove a gun. We just had cases in the last month. They had a guy that basically got a gun from his cousin that he used to threaten an ex-girlfriend. And then you had the case in South Minneapolis, a man who clearly should not have any guns around him, having access to guns and firing them indiscriminately. Thankfully, no one was injured there. But there clearly is a need for both of these rules to be on the table, and the Republicans just don't seem to be interested at all in doing anything. They seem to be following that order that came down from Representative Tony Cornish before he left, that they shouldn't touch guns at all, which is the guns are not the priority. Human life is the priority.
Well, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Kozelka, made a promise to the gun owners' advocacy groups at the beginning of the last session that absolutely no gun measures to reduce violence would pass while the Republicans had control of the Senate. That's the way they're operating on this. And it's really unfortunate because you're right. There's not only broad public support for this, but I think that if all of the senators were allowed to vote their conscience, they could probably pass these bills. But the Republican majority is unfortunately going to be enforcing their criteria on this. And I don't think they're going to have any votes on the floor over these bills. I don't think they'll even let it get out of committee. I doubt we even have a vote, frankly, in committee. But the public, including gun owners, is very strongly in support of these initiatives. Like you said, 80 to 90 general public, the general electorate, the voters, and because they get it. They understand that we've got to find a way at least to screen the people who are purchasing guns to see if they're eligible under existing law to possess that gun. No one is proposing, I'm not proposing, to expand the category of those who aren't eligible. I just want to apply existing law to that. But if you don't screen them, you have no idea if the buyer will be lawfully taking that gun or unlawfully taking that gun. And the existing laws for protecting individuals who have firearms in their home just don't give the police or the courts or family members the tools they need to prevent the violence from occurring. We need those tools. And around the country, they're proving effective. Mm-hmm. They are preventing suicides. They're preventing shootings. They're getting people the help that they need when they're in crisis. And the public gets that.
Mm-hmm.
The people that don't get it are the ones who are single-issue voters on the far right of the political spectrum, who are very avid gun owners and Second Amendment advocates, and to the point of feeling like they're afraid the government's going to come and take away their gun. I am not advocating for that, Matt. Let me be very clear on this. I am respecting their Second Amendment rights, and I know a lot of the people who are listening to this broadcast may be less concerned about that, but I am not going after Second Amendment rights. I'm trying to separate the guns from people who have a tendency or at risk for committing violent offenses against themselves or others. It is about the people here on these proposals. And if we pass these bills, it really will save lives.
It's one of the most lethal things you can own, making sure people have that are owning these guns or having these guns are safe to use them. I think that's just common sense. That's not extremism. That's just common sense. And the Supreme Court has ruled that we can do that. So this is not about confiscating guns. This is about making sure the people that have them are safe people to have those guns. And I think that that's a good call. I want to turn to a different issue, though. You got a firsthand knowledge of what I consider to be the modern game plan of the Republican Party. Back when Southwest Light Rail was there, you had an assurance from, at that point, Speaker Dowd that there was going to be funding in the bill, and you saw basically a straight-out lie, double-cross, which, you know, that if that Kurt Dowd gaveled the House closed to prevent from having to acknowledge that he had been lying about Southwest Light Rail funding. Of course, in the long run, Governor Dayton played him like a fiddle, and we got the Southwest Light Rail line passed. We saw this last session, specifically in the case of the Emergency Insulin Act, a bill that the Republicans had agreed to pass, and then for some reason double-crossed the Democrats and the people with diabetes who can't afford insulin in the state. For some inexplicable reason, they've been spending the rest of the year blaming the Democrats for their own actions. This just seems like the new plan that you can't really trust these guys to come forward even on the no-brainer bills like emergency insulin and do the right thing.
Well, unfortunately, this got caught up in the end of session disputes. And you're right, there's a lot of frustration by the Democrats who had a bill ready to go that we thought we had agreement on passed. Then the Senate majority didn't pass it, and it took them a long time to come to the table over the summer to even talk about it. Again, they started coming up with all sorts of other proposals and other funding mechanisms. The dispute even about whether they should have big pharma that's producing the insulin absorb the cost when they're providing insulin at $25 a dose in Canada. And here they're charging exorbitant amounts where people can't afford it. So the political environment is very, very fraught right now. There's not a lot of trust going around, even though some of us work very hard to build the trust across the aisle. So when we do have agreement, we can actually come forward and pass stuff. I would have thought we would have had a special session with an insulin agreement in September. But if it's not able to come together on it, particularly on the funding. And I don't know why there's a desire to protect the pharmaceutical companies here that, frankly, have been ripping off the insulin-dependent diabetic for a long, long time.
Well, and
we're just going to have to tackle it when the session opens in a month and a half. If you can't get it done then, the voters will have to decide who they trust to handle it come November.
Well, and it's frustrating because the modern stance from the Republican is, well, we'll pass our bill, but that's the only bill. But then blaming Governor Walz and saying Governor Walz, by not calling a special session, he's the one to blame because we're willing to pass our own bill. That's not negotiation. That's basically blackmail. And they don't seem it's ugly. On the positive side, though, you in your district is going to see a definitive benefit from this. The Southwest Light Rail Line, it's right by the radio station here in Eden Prairie. They are building like crazy. This Southwest Light Rail Line is going to be a great asset to the metro area.
You know, I'm really proud of having accomplished, along with many others who worked on this project, the Southwest LRT. You know, it was an issue when I first got into the legislature in 2003, so I fought for many years to get funding for planning. We did put together millions of dollars over the course of time to keep planning this so it was ready to go. And then, frankly, when the majority shifted, I fought against many efforts to stop Southwest LRT, legislative proposals that would have ended the funding, that would have banned LRT, that would have banned local governments from funding it as well. And in fact, that local government funding authorization was the piece that got hung up in the bonding bill as well, when Republicans sent over the bonding bill with 10 minutes to go at the end of session, and we sent it back with the piece back in it. They had it at their desk, and they adjourned anyway. But we've got the LRT coming. It's going to be great for the environment. It's going to get people to their jobs. There's 60,000 jobs within a short distance of this LRT line, and it's going to be really good for the metro area, for our economy. And it's, you know, a piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece of a system, but a really critical piece.
I've often made the joke, I think we need to give Kurt Dowd the first ride on the thing, but the reality is I hope they give you the first ride on it because you sure deserve it. You have done a lot of great, and it's going to not only benefit Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, Eden Prairie, the entire line. If it develops just like the other light rail lines did, this is going to be the positive development most communities just dream of.
Well, thank you, Matt. We'll take that first ride. The public clearly likes them because they exceed long-term ridership projections within the first few years of when they open. There's a demand for it, and it's what we need in this area.
Ron Latz, Senator Ron Latz, joining us. Okay, so one last thing I want to ask you about is let's look ahead towards 2020. Yeah, the Democrats have they're the minority, but not by many votes. You have a Democratic House, Melissa Hortman down there as the speaker, doing a great job. You got the Democratic governor. So as you brought up, you mentioned earlier, the Republicans are in a precarious position where they have to order Gazelka, Senate Majority Leader Gazelka has to order his entire base to basically vote along with him with no defections whatsoever. So it presents an interesting situation for you. What are going to be the priorities for the Senate Democrats as we look into 2020?
Well, you know, right now it's a 35-32 Republican majority in the Senate. And while we do find areas of common ground to pass things like the budget that we all came together on last year, you know, who controls the committees matters. Who controls the floor matters. There are things that we would like to do that we simply can't get done with the current majority. We need, for example, to find a way to fund the Bottineau Light Rail Line, which is the next piece of the expansion. We need to find a long-term solution to funding the Metro Transit bus system as well. And so we need to make some changes in the laws, and it's hard to do with people who basically don't support mass transit as an alternative. They think just highways and bridges are going to be enough to account for the massive increase in population we're going to see here. We need to, in my judgment, make some improvements in our K-12 education system, including trying to make sure we have long-term funding for school districts to be able to pay the teachers well, and to make sure there's sufficient support staff in the classrooms and in the school setting, such as counselors, to help guide the student body through their years in school. We've got a healthcare system that needs some stabilization as well. We've got a lot to run on, and not only insulin that we want to get done right.
Well, and I can.
We've got a lot to run on, but we need some new bodies in the legislature to be able to implement our agenda.
And I want to say this as a person who did metro traffic for many years. It's one thing to say, oh, well, we disagree with mass transportation. We're going to do more road construction. But the reality is the Republicans have screamed that more roads, more roads. They haven't even funded that. We still have a lot of substandard bridges in the state. The Republicans have not funded any money on that. And as well, the roads, I mean, it's one thing if you're for road construction, but then don't you think that your bill should have more road construction in them? Because right now, this metro area in Duluth and St. Cloud and Rochester, as well as many of our county and rural routes, they need upgrades, and there's just not the money outside of a handful of select projects, which usually benefit donors. The Republicans are not coming forward with the money for their own plans, let alone for a more comprehensive, unified plan, which we should be shooting for.
We need to have a long-term funding mechanism in place for transportation in Minnesota, and we don't have that right now. And that means not just bonding, but a revenue stream that is reliable, so we can plan 5 and 10 years down the road. Because some of these projects, they require that level of planning to make them happen. And, you know, I support a further increase in the gas tax, but there are other ways to do it as well. And, you know, the pump price fluctuates overnight more than any additional revenue enhancements would impact prices at the pump. If we don't do this, we just can't build out a meaningful transportation system, and we can't catch up on the backlog of road and bridge maintenance that we need as well. You know, this metro area in particular is going to grow by 1 million people in the next 20 or 25 years, are the projections. We can't build enough roads to accommodate that. We've got to have a robust mass transit system and intermodal system. And Greater Minnesota relies on roads to get to jobs and to get their agricultural products to market. So the whole state benefits when we put in place a long-term, reliable, stable transportation funding system. And you're right, the Republicans haven't been willing to come up with those revenues there. They're grabbing short-term or one-time dollars out of each budget cycle, and not enough at that.
They're looking. We need to have a common sense approach that looks at mass transportation, road construction, as well, in a unified package. And as long as you have one side of the aisle that's not unified, well, there you go, Senator. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this time. I am so lucky as a person, as one of your constituents, to have you as my state senator. You are brilliant. I will continue to vote for you as long as you continue to run. Thank you very much for the time, and happy holidays to you.
You're very kind, Matt. Thank you, and thank you to all of your listeners. Happy holidays to everyone.
Senator Ron Latz, Minnesota DFL District 46, kind enough to join us today. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Once again, thank you, Senator Ron Latz. Also, thank you very much to Representative Rena Moran. A great political roundup for you on your New Year's Day. Happy 2020. We are back. Another brand new to you show tomorrow right here on AM 950.